Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast about the galaxy's greatest comics, mostly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark, and my returning guest, making his fourth appearance in the book club, he is the Melbourne correspondent of the book club, although he's an expat. He's still one of us and not a socceroo. Luke Aldred returns.
Hey.
Hello, Luke.
Hi, Eamon. Thank you very much for that introduction. I'm not sure I could support anyone with a nickname of socceroos. It just sounds a bit daft. So, yeah. Stick to the three lines.
Yeah, okay. I mean, as we record this, it's the morning or the evening after the third place playoff and a 10-goal thriller. So,
Which nobody remembers anyway, but there we go.
No, exactly. Right. Let's get straight to it. It's your fourth appearance on the book club. One more for the T-shirt. What have you chosen to talk about on this visit?
Okay, so it's a bit of a twofer in that the work of Brett Ewins is a bit of an umbrella sort of focus with a particular focus on The Haunting of Sector House 9, one of his, we'll come into this later, but his favourite Dread story.
Perfect. Well, The Haunting of Sector House 9 appeared in Progs 359 to 363 in 1984, written by Wagner and Grant, obviously art by Brett Ewins. I think it's Tom Frame letters throughout. If you want to read along with us, you'll find the story in Case Files 7. And I'll just mention quickly two things. Firstly, to say that Case Files 7, having flicked through it on my iPad to get to this story, is an absolute banger of collection of stories. The Graveyard Shift, Cry of the Werewolf, and all of that before you get to this story. The other thing I'll quickly mention is that due to a miscommunication on my point, you'd also raised the book about Brett Ewins, The Art of Brett Ewins, which is still available, $9.99 print on demand from Amazon, and you've got a copy. I haven't got a copy of that, although I have ordered one, and we will be referring to that, or at least I'll be asking you about that as we go along, I think.
Yeah, it's a nice slim light. It's basically the size of a small trade paperback, which kind of feeds into maybe some of the themes of why hasn't Brett got something bigger and meatier, but we'll come and talk about that later, maybe.
Yes, because it is an interview. It was a big interview with him in it, I believe.
It's all interview, and I believe it is Alan McKenzie. He stands as the copy editor, so I presume he's the person that it's peppered with questions, but it's basically Brett's own thoughts and words,
right,
on his work.
So why particularly did you want to talk about Brett Ewins? What was your first encounters with his work, and why did you want to bring him up for the podcast?
Well, initially, Brett Ewins, his work sits in that, you know, the description of many of the classic 2000 AD artists as, first of all, it's just a bit weird. It wasn't like anything else you saw with from other comics on the newsstand. You know, certainly not the American ones that I saw in the newsagents in Solihull, West Midlands, or W. H. Smith's or whatever. So he sits in that bracket with Mick McMahon and Kevin O'Neill. His early work was very kind of visceral and creepy in a way, and I'll say that in a nice way. It's very organic. There's lots of inking, lots of luscious. I mean, I've tried to think of the adjectives. I put creepy, I put luscious. The couple of episodes that first stood out for me from him, which I've, when you're little and you're first reading the comics, it's those particular stories and those artists that step out as they stick in your mind as, oh, this is different. I will keep a lookout for this. And it was the early Dread stories, the DNA Man, I think it's called, which is the very Frankenstein-y, classic, taking a recognizable trope and putting a megacity spin on it. So there was a sort of Frankenstein kind of story. And then also into Judge Cal story, The Day the Law Died, which a famous little episode, part of that story, sprawling story, but the moment where Cal decides that his up to then faithful henchman, Judge Slocum, was looking too worried and too down. So he paralyzed him, you know, turned his face into a grin, and then pickled him, and sort of just, and it's one of those classic kind of 2000 AD Judge Dredd images that, you know, there's a thought bubble coming out of Judge Slocum as he's being lowered into a big, you know, almost like a comedy test tube. It's again, it's where the 2000 AD becomes part goodies, part something horror, whatever. Just something totally bizarre and fairly unpleasant, putting him in a big test tube, and there he gets pickled. So it's those early days that sort of put him on the radar. And then I think the Rogue stories, which again carried on that very heavy, you know, inking and luscious jungles, and, you know, really feeding into that Vietnam style element to the stories. I know lots of them were sort of First World War or Second World War style, but lots of them were that sort of jungly story. So yeah, so it didn't take long for him to sort of stand out as one of those of a few artists that did stand out. If that kind of answers your question.
Yeah.
And then he obviously goes, I mean, his style changes quite drastically, I don't know, but when he gets into his stride, which we'll talk about, I think, later on, in his own words, in the art of Brett Ewins, after Rogue Trooper, he really felt he was in the stride, and that's where our chosen story today, Sector House 9, comes in. I think it's his first return, or his return to do a long Dread, or, you know, five-parter Dread after Rogue. And he's really happy himself with his own artwork, and it just fit. And that's the start, I think, of a real purple patch for him, of Sector House 9, the Possessed story, the Anderson story, obviously Bad Company, and I guess before that as well, his Rogue Trooper work.
Well, let's look at this snapshot of his work on Judge Dredd, a Judge Dredd story from 1984, The Haunting of Sector House 9. Before we get into talking about some of the story points and particularly his artwork, quick synopsis. What's The Haunting of Sector House 9 about?
Okay, well, I think this is Amityville horror in the Big Meg, to be honest.
Right.
So we talk about how the writers sort of pick up on the zeitgeist things. And I think the Amityville horror was a big thing, certainly in the playground when I was at school, people talking about this, you know, have you heard this? Have you seen it on the news? Have you heard a film? It's all real, honest. So it's a classic haunted house, but in Mega City 1, so it's a sector house. It opens with a classic, you know, crowd scene of all the different things going on. It's packed with little jokes, you know, judges interrogating people. It just sort of sets the scene of what happens in a everyday sector house. I don't know if that was the first time sector houses were really explained or went into. I don't know with that. I'm not a scholar enough for that. And it turns out there's problems afoot because the Sector House judge took his own life, died by suicide. Highly unusual, because Dredd points out judges don't do that. They're somehow, you know, more stoic. They've got, you know, whatever psychological training to avoid that kind of stuff. And then when they step into the room, it's your classic haunted house horror, dripping walls, blood, and all sorts of, you know, classic tropes.
Yeah, very much the haunted house story in, as you say, Mega City 1. Lots of creepy stuff and people going into rooms where something weird suddenly happens.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned this book is, you know, also contains Cry the Werewolf. So I think it fits into that little series of where Judge Dredd did. Judge Dredd does Hammer horror, or does Universal horror. It's the classic sort of horror tropes, like the werewolf, blood of Satanus. I'd put in there as well. You know, that's dripping in the same sort of menace and over the top ghoulishness. So yeah, it's sort of playing it up for all it's worth. They bring in the side judges, Geller first of all. So I'm wondering if that was, you know, a play on Uri Geller.
Sure it was, nice. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Everything's fine. They don't, you know, they can't see anything at first. And then, you know, he spends the night there. And then, the cameras go dark. Temperature drops. And poor old Geller, stuck in the room, sees blood running on the walls. And Judge Dredd does one of his, one of Brett Ewins' signature moves is the big run. You know, he loves figures that have got a big exaggerated run, all elbows and knees, powering down, powering towards us. He comes thundering in, and that's when, going into part two, it really kicks up a notch. And it goes from, I would say, it goes from a bit of the, you know, like I say, the Hammer horror classic Universal. It goes into a bit of The Thing, or some sort of David Cronenberg. There's a creeping, you know, the blood forms a creeping hand. It creeps up Geller's knee pad. He can't move. Dread bursts in. Some sort of psychological power is trying to make Dread shoot himself. He overcomes it, of course, because I think he says earlier on in the episode he's got a double zero rating against psychic stuff or something. Again, he's the boss. Blasts the disembodied hand, and it splatters on the wall to make screaming mouths, which again is a great image and one of the ones that, I knew Brett Ewins by this time, but that, I mean, if that doesn't stick in your mind, yeah, what will?
I think the screaming mouths on the wall is one of the, as you say, one of the sort of landmark images from this story. And as you say, yeah, preceded by some body horror, by a creeping hand, a disembodied hand, which horror loves. The mouths on the wall, for some reason, reminded me of the arms coming out of the wall in Day of the Dead. As you say, 2018, not shy about borrowing from horror tropes that perhaps its readership were aware of in the playground but couldn't actually see on screen. Yeah.
And plus, you just, yeah. And I think one of the mouths has got another little mouth on the top lip.
Yes.
Which I think, you know, Brett has said at some, you know, he likes that sort of, he was really influenced by the weird tales and the pulp magazines that you got serialized, you know, the lurid, over-the-top front covers and then the fairly, you know, risque stories inside. And that's pure one of those, that sort of thing. But in classic Dredd and Judge Dredd style, they're not just screaming antiquated, you know, evil dead-like slogans. They're saying, you know, you think you're so smart, Mr. Fancy Pant Judge, Mr. Big Shot, you know, you're all wrong, Beathead, which is a bit of a, which is the first clue, I believe. The first clue to actually solving the mystery. And then it just escalates from there. Again, in sort of, you know, it's a great little example of a shortish story, five parts, that would actually, you could see it being a great team, you know, movie. You know, the setting, you know, the setup at the beginning, and then it just escalates, and you know, sure enough, things start kicking off around the Sector House. You know, there's emergency calls from the interrogation cubes. There's the, you know, things whizzing around the room. Again, it's sort of tied in with, you know, Poltergeist, I think, was big at that early 80s sort of time, although I could be getting my dates a little bit wrong here. And it all just starts kicking off, and Dredd has to come up with a plan, which is to evacuate, but stealthily, because we don't want the ghosts to notice what we're up to.
And I think you pointed out in your notes, we get the chief Psy judge turning up to help out once we realise that things are perhaps a little bit beyond Psy Judge Geller.
Yeah, yeah. He calls in the big boys.
Which means we get possibly the first appearance of the new Psy Chief.
Yeah, he does. I've just got to say, before that happens, though, you really get the, I talked about The Thing a minute ago and body horror, when the body's in the morgue. So the start of episode, what is it, episode three?
Yeah.
One of the was it Drucker who got
crushed.
And again, if you remember The Thing, the famous scene in The Thing when they're trying to revive the guy with the you know, the electric pads, he suddenly bursts into life, and again it's another terrific Brett Ewins body horror of ex Judge Drucker, but this time he's got two mouths. They're both screaming with tongues and teeth and all sorts coming out, and he, you know, proceeds to dispose of a poor judge who's only there to help to look after the bodies. And then the zombies all start coming up, and for some reason there's the dead in the mortuary, even though they probably only died really recently, are all classic zombified with nasal cavities showing and hair dripping out, and they have to be subdued with a good old riot foam. Then, as you said, Omar arrives. Now, does he have a long career after this? I, to be honest, I couldn't remember. I know he features in Oh, actually, does he feature in the samurai story, and that's his
song? I think he gets killed off in the Seven Samurai story, yes. Yeah. And I think this is his first appearance as Chief Sai Judge, because the previous one, I believe, I'm just looking it up, X had been killed in the Apocalypse War. So we get Sai Judge Omar with his turban, a Sikh judge.
I know, which I thought was interesting. I just really sort of twigged that, because I believed, you know, religion was, and certainly in the Justice Department, I assume would be agnostic. Is that the term?
Yeah.
But, you know, he's there. He's obviously there, and he looks good with it. So, he's a great addition to the cast.
I remember a few years ago, there was an awful lot of fuss when a judge wearing a hijab turned up in the prog, and people made a big fuss about that. But actually, way back in 1984, his chief, you know, side judge Omar in his turban.
And there's Judge Patel as well, who's the other named character, isn't he? So it's funny that they've got Omar and Patel. It's quite a nice multi-ethnic flavour there.
Yes, and you know, we should probably give a nod to them to say that at times early 2000 AD could be racially insensitive. Here they seem to be, you know, being much more positive, which is good.
There's no big deal. It's just part of their character. And again, he looks a great character, the double eagle. I don't know if that was just Brett's idea, or did the side judge's chief judge always wear a double eagle and a huge badge.
Yeah, he looks great.
Yeah. So that precedes a bit of an uptick in the phantom, the ghosts business. The following pages, we get more screaming mouths. This time, though, they're appearing on monitors all over the sector house. And again, on what would it be, the second or third page of that episode? Three, the third is very, I thought, alien influence there, maybe Videodrome, David Cronenberg. So these screaming mouths appearing on monitors, the glass smashes of what, and this mouth comes shooting out, and the implication is it's bitten the poor guy that's on the screen. But then the villain, which is no giveaway, but he plays a card too much, and he screams in Dredd's face, "Dredd, rot your slimy chin," which is obviously an insult only a ghost could come up with.
Absolutely.
But as we find out, that's going to be his undoing.
Because Dredd, with his instant recall, recognises, or at least can describe, the dentition to the computer.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. I put in my notes, you know, we don't need the Dark Knight detective, we just need the dental detective.
Dental detective does it, yes.
He's got it, yep. So that is following that, I should say, a page which we may well come back to, but the page where the ghost has had enough and he's screaming, "Now you will pay," is actually, this page is, again, in the art of Brett Ewins. He talks about his being, it's his favourite page, it's his favourite Dredd page in his favourite Judge Dredd story. So,
nice.
Are you looking at it at the same time?
Yes, I am. The "Now you will pay" page.
Absolutely. And yeah. I was looking at that. So I actually, you know, looked at it and read what he talked about. And there's some amazing just work on scale and playing with pace just on that one page. So you've got on the left, you've got the horizontal "Now you will pay" from top to bottom with the rocks falling and the judges at the bottom. Then you've got a couple of horizontal panels in the top right where, again, the judges are dodging the falling masonry and all that. And then you've got a shift of scale to the hot. You see the whole sector house, complete with, you know, the figures down the bottom, legging it out the entrance as quick as they can. And then one of these little things that just stick in your memory. Paul Amcor. I don't know who he is. He's only had his name mentioned once. But they look up and they say, "Look, there's a fire in the med bay." And this is poor lad. Who's a lad? Poor judge is, you know, leaping out on fire, bandages round his head. They're on fire, and he's leaping to his death. And it's also a page of mouths, isn't it? When you think about it, because you've got the "Now you'll pay," the big mouth screaming with a tongue. You've got, I'm not sure if it's Dredd doing the shouting, "Look, fire in the med bay." His mouth is open. He's shouting. He's screaming. You've got poor old Amcor, leaping out the med bay. His mouth's open. Obviously, he's screaming. His tongue's sticking out. So it is very It's a kind of in-your-face, visceral, lots of body horror, lots of shouting, lots of screaming, but it's a great action-filled page.
Yes, and lots of, yes, as you say, this story features lots of mouths by Brett Ewing.
Yeah.
It's also followed by Omar sort of taking charge with the Lawmasters, where they get the Let's Ride moment, which is fantastic and leads to a nice double-page spread at the start of part four.
Yeah, because that's something that, like, Judge Dredd does so well, is the Let's Ride.
Yeah.
They all leap on. It's like whether they're, you know, about to challenge Judge Cal. I remember that one. And there's, like, several other instances where, enough messing about, we've just got to leap on the big bikes and get things done. And he does, yeah. He takes control. That leads, I think this, oh, it's not the final thing, but there's a great splash page, as you said, where, again, one of Brett Ewing's motifs or, you know, habits, there's a repeat of previous images. Amcor is there again. And they more or less repeat, like a good old 1930s serial, they kind of repeat the same beats, they repeat the same speech. I don't know if that was often done with the, it's a bit of a device, I know, but it's just, it's interesting the way they more or less repeated the same text and the same images. But it's a great 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 horizontal panels going across the page.
Then they solve the dental problem with the computers, and that's obviously going to lead us up to the location of the ghost and the final confrontation.
Absolutely, which is some more. Again, they amp up the creepy house. They get an identity for this criminal. They get this backstory that yes, he was a psychic criminal that the sector house judge decided they should lean on as soon as he moved into the sector. So that's where he gets his revenge, you know, driven from. Yeah, they go to his house. Oh, before they do that, they realize yes, actually, we shot him. And then we left him alone for an hour. And Dredd says, well, why on earth did you leave him alone? That's not protocol. And he's like, my gosh, you're right. Why did I leave him alone? And it's a bit of the old Jedi mind trick. You know, the not dead. I can't remember his name now.
Tamerlane,
that's it. The not dead Tamerlane used his psychic powers to convince everyone there that he'd been shot dead. So they left him alone so he could then, you know, crawl into this secret space and hatch his dastardly plan. Do you want me to carry on, just wrap it up?
Well, let's leave the ending as a sort of spoiler free, as it were, as to how they resolve the issue. What else would you like to say about Brett's artwork on the Sector 9 story?
Like I said, it's a bit of a halfway house between where he came from, and this is just my own, you know, COD theory. I'm not scholar in this at all, but like I said, I was really entranced with his early work with Brendan McCarthy. They're two very similar approaches, you know, very heavily lots of blacks, very heavily shaded, you know, all the line work, but it also, you can also see where he's going to with his Anderson work that comes, and it begins to get cleaner. So it's a bit of both, a bit clear, cleaner, a bit freer of so much, you know, sort of blacks and maybe the shading. He sort of cut back on the line shading. You can see some of his motifs in that there are some panels. I won't try and, you know, dig them out here, but you can see there's evidence where they've done where he's done something else that he became well known for, which is just repeating the same image. So I presume he'd photocopy it and use. There's a couple of judge things where they zoom in, so he obviously enlarges it on a photocopier. So I just think that's quite a nice, you know, he chose to be a little bit inventive, a little bit innovative. I like the little Dredd heads, the sort of judge heads talking with their badge next to them. So it's like, you know, there's not just two characters standing in a corridor. He just draws the face and their badge next to them to say that they're talking. And then the other one answers, just his face and his badge next to him. So yeah, it's just, it's a great ride. I was a little bit disappointed, I must admit, when I first read it, that it turned into a kind of Scooby-Doo, where it wasn't a demon, it wasn't a true ghost, it was a... Oh, well, again, I was going to spoil it there. But it's not exactly where you think it's going. It turns into a more sort of, yeah, I would have got away with it if it wasn't for you darn judges, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I noted that the first episode gets a double page spread, as you say, that great sort of mayhem inside the Sector House. Then the double page spreads return, because obviously they must have got the center pages for episode 4 and 5, and particularly the double page spread at the start of episode 5. As you said, Brett Ewins, they sort of recap very briefly what's gone on at the end of the previous episode. But the one on episode 5 is this wonderful sort of cinematic look at Bleak Mansions, which I presume is a play on Bleak House. And Chief Judge, or Side Judge Omar, I keep calling him Chief Judge, but Side Judge Omar, front and centre. It's wonderful. You know, the perspective on that is great. Very cinematic, I thought.
Yeah. I think he's, and again, this is, you know, sort of things I think is probably employed by a lot of artists, but they know when to leave, when to put the city in the background and then when to leave it out.
Yeah.
So you know, you get that expanse image at the top and then the others is just sort of down the bottom. It's the judges and it's white behind them. You don't need to see anything else.
Mm. Brilliant. Well, we will be coming back to some of these pages later on in this episode when we get to Grails. But let's turn to just Brett Ewins himself. Can you tell us a little bit about his life, his work up until this point, beyond, and then the sort of slightly darker turn the rest of his life took?
Yeah. I mean, again, I'll just preface this by, you know, I'm no expert, and I wouldn't pretend to be, but when I... you know, when I sort of read about how things turned out for him, then I was obviously, you know, quite saddened by that and sort of went back and read a little bit more and sort of tried to understand what it must have been like. I also met him several times at the good old UKCAC. I went through a nice patch of going from 86 to 92 or something like that, 91. And I was just in those great years. I was 16 in 86. And it just, you know, the world was just opening up for me as as someone trying to be an artist. I went to art college and meeting all these guys, and he looked like one of his characters, put it that way. One of the time I met him, he had this like a bright fluorescent pink blazer, skin tight trousers, his sort of crew cut brothel creepers. I'm not sure you're supposed to call them brothel creepers now, but big suede shoes with a big, and again, he had a very, it's like, I think when he draws boots in Road Trip or Bad Company, he was almost using his own shoes for style inspiration. He had huge soles, and he was just the friendliest. You know, back in those days, you didn't have to queue so much. You could just sort of more or less stroll up and chat and the people would be in the bar, and he was just the friendliest guy. So yeah, and I just, like I said, I tuned into his early work. Did you want me to give a bit of a potted history then?
Yes, let's do that.
Yeah. So first of all, growing up, he was interested in pulp magazines and the weird tales and that sort of lurid, over the top sort of, you know, imagery. And then he went to Goldsmiths Art College in London. He met Peter Milligan there. I think he went with Brendan McCarthy, but he also knew Brendan McCarthy before then. I think they met when they were 14, and they both used to knock around. It talks about in the book there, they'd knock around and in their sort of skinheads and Harrington jackets and Dr. Martens. And again, you can see themselves in some of the characters that they both drew. You know, McCarthy still draws. At Goldsmiths, he was really into, apparently, you know, sort of high art, conceptualism, you know, who's, a, you know, Duchamp, people like that, which is funny considering the pulp throwaway, you know, style with comics. However, he soon got back into comics and really used his collaborations with, you know, with Brendan McCarthy and Peter Milligan, and they created something called Sometimes Stories, so these little sort of fanzines, I guess, which again, a few of them are reproduced in the book, just the front covers, you know, lots of those weird McCarthy and Ewins style sort of futuristic characters, and on the back of that, they were able to get covers and future shot work in 2000 AD, and he soon sort of got into, you know, he was given a few dreads. A couple of the early dreads, like I said, the DNA Man and the Cow Story. He did a ABC Warriors, which I'd totally forgotten about until I saw that red. So I went back and, you know, searched through them, and there's an ABC Warriors story back in the Magnificent Seven days, back in the early days. So on the back of the some of those dreads, I believe he then got the Rogue Trooper gig after one of the artists to sort of fill in after Dave Gibbons left. He was asked to draw in a style of Dave Gibbons to try and sort of carry on that, you know, through lines, which, you know, he found a little bit frustrating at first, but you soon see where his work came through, especially in stories like Fort Neuro, which again ties into his slightly. I was listening to one of Conrad's collected Space Spinner things, and they were having a ball with just going through how crazy Fort Neuro is with each you know successive group that they meet, and it sort of played into that. And as he says in the book, he felt when he came off Rogue Trooper, he was just that much more accomplished. He hits this purple patch of Sector House 9, I think the Wally Squad soon after. He's then asked to take over the the Judge Anderson story. Now, talk about Poison Chalice. You've got a character who's, you know, become fabulously popular, but also with, you know, possibly one of the best artists the comics ever had and will have. And he's asked to carry on from there. So he did, he, you know, manfully gave it a go. But he said he was asked to draw like somebody else. I wasn't a fly on the wall, so I don't know the conversations. But according to the book, they were very, very much encouraged to follow Brian Bolland's style, copy his fine brushwork, which must be incredibly daunting and frustrating for an artist, I can imagine. I love the exposure, but a tricky job. And I think he began to feel that he couldn't do that, and he stepped away from that, and I think it was Robin Smith and Cliff Robinson finished that one off. What have I got here? So, yeah, a bit of break away from Anderson, but then he returned to Anderson with The Possessed, which was much more him, and this is one of my favourite stories. I know you've already covered The Possessed, haven't you? So I don't want to say too much about...
Not sure we have, actually. Did we cover it in the first Sci-Files, possibly?
You might have, I'm sure. I'm sure I listened to it. I thought, yeah. But that is classic. That is, that again, and that's where I think he really hit his stride. Because like I said, he's moved from all this, you know, very dark and lots of shading to something that I think he did really well, which I think you could see also his pop art influences. You know, Roy Lichtenstein and all those kind of things.
Yes.
I think he just embodied that, you know, comics are dames with long hair and like shooting guns, and the heavies with gun, you know, tough heavies shooting guns, and very kind of, this is pulp. It's that, again, those pulp influences. You know, don't you think a lot of his Judge Dredd, you know, his heavies in Dredd or Johnny Nemo, which we might talk about, or Screamer, they all look kind of 50s. You know, there's lots of the pencil-thin moustaches.
Yes, very much, yeah.
You know, eyebrows are like, you know, Johnny Nemo's eyebrows is like lightning slashes. You know, the waistcoats, they're very dapper, aren't they? Lots of zoot suits. In the, you know, big shoulders, waistcoats, big pants. Like I said, these big brothel creeper crepe shoes type, blue suede shoes. But because it's the future, everyone's got to have a Mohican, so they had Mohicans as well. And monocles as well, I've noticed. He firmly believed that the future, the monocle was going to return because the you know, futuristic eyewear was a big thing. So, yeah, so again, the purple patch, I think maybe because of the success of Possessed, I don't know, but he was able to then state his own terms a little bit with Bad Company, which I know you have done.
Yes.
And he was allowed to do Bad Company in its entirety, wasn't he, before they started to serialise it. Him, you know, Peter Milligan and himself, they came up with a story, they went backwards and forwards. And maybe, again, this might be a stretch, but I talked about his, you know, high art conceptualist background in at Goldsmiths. You know, Bad Company is not just a war story. There was, you know, philosophy and, you know, pondering on, you know, the big questions, as well as shooting aliens that are called the Krul, who have these huge heads, which could be, I could go off on Bad Company here as well. But So yeah, that mixture of the deep and the thoughtful and the philosophical, but also the downright pulpy craziness. I mean, The Cruel, how great are the designs of The Cruel? That's something else he's really good at,
yeah.
The character designs. I think they almost said, we need an alien race, but it's an alien race that a man could wear in a suit in a Doctor Who episode. You know, nothing too H.R. Geiger, nothing too outlandish. We want a big, horrible monster with a big head, eyes, teeth everywhere. You know, The Cruel, the name, it does what it says, you know, should do what it says on the tin sort of thing. Yeah, so again, a bit of a magnum opus. They were given the room to breathe, to say, go and do this, come back to us when it's done. He did it all on double size, I think it was, whether it was A3, certainly double the size it was printed at. He talked about research in the book. He talks about researching all the panels. Yeah, so that's again like a big hit for him and a big win, and it's rightly very popular in the comic, and it had two or three sequels. Unfortunately, that's where I think it just got the work began to get quite, the demands started to play on him. He talks in the book about, you know, when you're a freelance artist, you can't refuse a
can't say no.
Yep. Yeah. So, you know, getting calls late one night to say, can you have a cover by the morning? So pulling an all-nighter. You know, he talks about living with Steve Dillon, who could do that kind of stuff, you know, well known for that, but he was not one of those. At the same time, he was also working with Steve Dillon on, you know, Deadline, which again is a fabulous legacy. You know,
founded in 1988.
Yep. He started work on Screamer around about the same time.
Yeah, that comes out the following year for DC Comics. We've done that one on the podcast as well. Yep.
And he also, there's examples of work that he did for DC, like Hellblazer, you know, little episodes here and there. So he was working, but the strain just started to take its toll. Yeah, I think he had a breakdown. He just found it, incredibly difficult to keep up. You know, he was given lots of, he went on a sort of, quite a heavy medicated sort of regime of, sleeping tablets to help him sleep and medication to deal with the sort of breakdown. And that then led, I believe, again, I keep saying I believe because, I wasn't there and I haven't got sort of chapter and verse, but, you know, that led into episodes of, paranoid schizophrenia, which he's quite honest about in the book. So it's quite tragic that he went from sort of these real high points at the 80s to just getting too much, and in the early 90s just being, you know, his work rate just slowed right down to a trickle, just because he couldn't do it, because he was on medication, just finding it so difficult. And he kind of disappeared, I think, for, again, I'm making broad strokes here, but the work slowed down through the 90s. Found that very difficult. Looked like he was turning the corner. The book, this book came out in 2011. It talks about the 2000s, whatever you want to call it. Began to get back on track. Still having periods of, he talked about periods of elation, but also, you know, depression. And anyone knows mental illness knows it's not, you know, doesn't go away, with tablets kind of thing. And unfortunately, 2012, even though he was, you know, looked like he was sort of turning a corner, police were called to an incident in his house. It escalated. A police officer ended up getting injured with a knife, and he was incarcerated without his medication. And he found that very difficult. He got quite sick in prison. I'm not sure how long he was there for, but when he came out, I think he was not the man he was before. That led to obviously, you know, health complications, and unfortunately passed in 2015 at the age of just in his 50s, I think.
Was he just 50? I think
born in 55, so 45. Too young anyway.
Yeah, very tragic. Not the ending of his career that we would have hoped for him. And as you say, that enormous golden age in the late 80s when he was firing on all cylinders at 2000 AD. He was starting Deadline with Steve Dillon, and he did Screamer for DC. He made the jump to American Comics. But as you say, he just couldn't turn work down, and it was too much, really, wasn't it? It all led to a breakdown.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what, obviously, different artists have got different, you know, page rates that they can, that they can produce. He talked about spending two days on a page, I think it was, just his normal sort of work rate, 2 days on a page. You know, so that's 10 days to create a 5-page episode of something.
Of a weekly comic, yeah.
Yeah, which may be, I mentioned at the beginning that I always thought it's kind of slightly strange that he doesn't, he's not that he doesn't get the recognition he deserved, because obviously lots of people recognise that, you know, the work and what he, you know, gave to 2000 AD and the comics world, but he's not, I often feel, sometimes think he's not talked about that often, or his work isn't talked about, and I'm thinking, is it just simply because he wasn't able to, not pump out, because that's a derogatory term, but he wasn't able to produce to the same level or you know, amount that other artists were. So he didn't do many dreads. You know, he only did, you know, a few of the early ones, and then Sector House 9 and the Wally Squad. If he was able to, you know, if he had a faster, you know, rate at producing work, would that have put him in the public comics, public eye more? Would he have had achieved greater success? I don't know. Again, I'm just theorizing there. He was a great collaborator as well.
Yes,
you know, from his early days with McCarthy, you know, they were sort of interchangeable. You looked at some of their work, and it's like, who's doing the pencils? Who's doing the, you know, who's doing the inks? Obviously, Steve Dillon collaborated on Screamer. Great collaborations, writing collaborations with Milligan, where they would interchange their stories. Even on Rogue Trooper, they talked about him and Cam Kennedy would sort of sit and go through the scripts. I believe, I'm not an expert, but I believe there was some issues, you know, interpreting Jerry Finley Day's scripts, great as, you know, the stories are, how can they turn that into a comic? So, you know, who's outgoing? He loved to collaborate. Yeah.
The question I put in our notes, which I don't think we're going to be able to answer, but was something to do with the rights of creators. And I didn't mean the rights to own their artwork. I meant sort of like, I don't know what you'd say, employment and welfare rights. Because mostly, particularly I think in the British comics industry, they're all independent freelancers, as you say.
Yeah.
They're all dependent on the next gig, and also dependent on their ability to be able to say, you know, to say yes to everything and to do the work on time. And I don't think they're paid well enough. I don't think they're looked after well enough. And I don't think there's any sort of long-term care. One of the recurring subjects that we bring up on this podcast, I think, or in conversations with fans, is there's no pension scheme for independent comic book artists, is there?
No.
It's a very perilous state to be in a way.
Yeah, you just have to assume that these guys that are able to move onto just sort of covers work, then they're in the promised land. They've achieved some sort of you know, status and security that they can step back a little bit. But yeah, it's a fairly punishing. Everyone, you know, a comic, you know, it's a lot of drawing. It's a lot of people on a page.
Yeah,
and I do wonder maybe if that's how some of his design choices, you know, the repetition of when he would photocopy, you know, one face and then enlarge it. Yes, it's got sort of artistic, you know, the zooming in. It's effectively the camera zooming in on, you know, someone's face, which is great because, you know, the resolution on a photocopied image is grainy. So you really get that sort of, I'm zooming in on, you know, the eyes or whatever. But also a bit of a time saver because then you don't have to draw that particular page. He also had a bit of a reputation for, should we call it, like homages to other artists, you know, which is fine because I think he was asked to do that a lot of the time. Can you draw Rogue Trooper like Dave Gibbons? Can you do Anderson like, you know, Brian Bolland? But, it, you know, there's several pictures where you see, I've seen that dread before. You know, there's a dread one. There's a Steve Dillon looking dread face in Sector House 9, which, you know, but I think he does it because that's what I do. I'm an artist and I draw from all different, you know, experiences, and that's what I'll put in the work. So yeah, I don't think there's a problem with that.
I always think his profile of dread looks very much like his friend Steve Dillon's chin, you know, or rather the way Dillon drew dread's chin, you know, I can see that in Ewing's version as well. But as you say, you know, they were friends, they were collaborators, they were working together. It's not too surprising, really, is it?
I've got to say his eagle as well, before I forget, because it's always a bit of a barometer for like how successful a dread artist is. When he got going, the eagle turned into this actual something that you looked at it and said, yes, I can see how that would make sense on a uniform. You know, he scaled it right back. Just sat on the shoulder with a couple of sort of, small wings. I just thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
Just very clean all over. And again, that sense of design that he bought. And again, Johnny Nemo, who graces the front cover of The Art of Brett Ewins, is a sort of a masterclass in how to produce a character with an instantly recognizable silhouette. You know, he's got like a huge platinum blonde Mohican. He's got a square chin. He's got these, you know, big shoulder, big sort of looks like a shoulder padded jacket with that recognizable diagonal pattern. You know, it's all, designed to a T.
Is there anything we as fans can do to help with the welfare of the creators that we love? I looked into this UK-based Comics Creators Network, but I missed the myth. I still don't know very much about what it does. And if anybody does know more about it, please get in touch with me and let me know, and we'll talk about it on the pod, perhaps. It is a tricky situation. I mean, I suppose one of the things I could have done was bought the Art of Brett Ewins in 2011 when it came out, which sadly I did not know about and didn't.
It's very under the radar. I didn't. I just found it on a Google, you know, search on Brett Ewins. I guess just buy the work.
Yeah.
Keep having the conversations about, the not plight as such, but the conditions that lots of people work under.
Yeah. It is a sad situation to look back on the end of his career and the end of his life as being so unfortunate. Devastating in a way.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, it's tragic, really.
I would say that The Art of Brett Ewins, the slim trade that you've got, which is mainly an interview and some of his reprints of some of his artwork, is available still print on demand from Amazon over here in the UK. It's £9.99. I've just ordered a copy. And The Haunting of Sector House 9, as I've said, is in Case Files 7, which is another great collection of dread stories, and it's in there.
Did I hear, though, they're reprinting Sector House 9? It's getting a... I'm not sure if I imagine that.
No, I don't know about it. I haven't heard that one.
In that case, I could be wrong, but that's... I wasn't sure if I imagined that, but yeah.
Well, let's hope so.
Yeah, definitely.
And let's hope possibly some of the profits from that might go to mental health charities or maybe the Comics Creators Network to see if they can help with the welfare of creators.
Definitely.
Let's go to a slightly cheerier subject. What is Brett Ewins' best work and what is his lasting legacy for 2000 AD?
You probably wouldn't get too many arguments against Bad Company. That, you know, when it came out in Prog 500, I think, wasn't it, the first episode?
Yeah.
That really had a bit of a lasting impression because it was, you know, yes, future war stories, you know, we had Rogue and VCs and things like that, but this really, you know, it matched the action with the sort of Heart of Darkness style musings on, you know, lots of things, and the subsequent sequels. I know they weren't as impactful, but a sequel by its very nature isn't going to be, because you're not going to see it for the first you're not seeing it for the first time. Yeah, Sector House 9 and the Wally Squad. You know, he's done other things, obviously, little bits and pieces. You forget, you know, he was there in 78, you know, right near the very beginning. And to go right through, I know he did less well-known or less popular, I'm not sure, the Universal Soldier. And is it Kelly's Eye, The Return of Kelly's Eye? When was that? Early 90s. So that'd be when he was just getting, you know, particularly ill. So
yeah,
so he went from 78 to 91, You know, so he's been there all through.
In this astonishing period of production that he was doing.
Yeah.
I mean, as you say, Bad Company, a huge favourite with 2000 AD fans. Episode 155 of this podcast with Roland and Goyd Thomas. Screamer, we've done with James Peattie, episode 113. We've also recently, Giles Wright and I did the Undercover Brothers collection, which includes the Wally Squad story. So if you want to see Brett Ewins's sort of 40s inspired gangsters, but also the future Mohawks, then that's the story for you. That was episode, 333, I guess.
155, was it? No?
That was Bad Company, yeah. Yeah, the Undercover Brothers is a very recent one, 333, I think. Right, let's go to Grail Pages. So while we're staying on the sort of cheery side of things, let's talk about a Grail Page or two from The Haunting of Sector House 9. What did you have in mind, Luke?
Well, let's have a look. I think I did already mention it. It is the...
Now You Will Pay.
That's the one. You knew what was going. Thanks, mate. There we go. So it's the final page on episode...
Episode 3 of Sector House 9. Yep.
So, again, now, and you, because the page is reproduced in the art of Brett Ewins, and you can see where he has the mouth, the screaming mouth, Now You Will Pay, is a, you know, a photocopy that's been reproduced, possibly enlarged, and sort of placed over that part of the page. And yeah, just like I said, the change, you know, the changing of the scale, you know, the action beats.
It's got a bit of everything. It's got that wonderful vertical panel of Now You Will Pay. It's got Judge Omar. It's got Dredd's helmet being crushed by falling masonry.
Yeah.
The Sector House itself being torn apart. To judge.
There's also examples which you can't really see. And again, this is the problem with the case vase a little bit, because in this reproduction, you can see where he's used the, is it letter tone? You know, the sort of tracy letter tone. So where the judge is looking up saying, look, fire in the med bay, it just looks sort of a bit inky and blobby behind the dreads, the judge's face. But in the book, you can see it's actually gray scale, you know, all one tone, you know, shading of some sort. And Brett actually says, you know, in the book, you know, that he'd worked up his techniques on Rogue Trooper, and they really show in this series. He said, I went for action and detail, and this is one of my favourite and most accomplished pages. I was imagining this strip as a film, as it should be. The storytelling is great, and the cutting between scenes is dynamic. I put as much detail as I could, and I was very pleased with my clear inking. So you could see how he was seeing, you know, he's imagining it as an edited, you know, edited scenes, cut scenes between. So yeah, I think it's great. And just the final panel of the page of the little, you know, figure, which is quite comic-y in a way. You know, you've got almost like Wile E. Coyote disappearing off the cliff. You know, you've got disappearing away, but it's the poor guy on fire leaping to his death.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, very black humor, but in a. So that's my page, definitely.
So that's your Grail Page from The Haunting of Sector House 9. I might take the next page, which is Judge Omar saying, let's ride. Nice page of Omar, Dredd, Lawmasters, and the sort of teaser into the next episode, straight from the horror's mouth. So I might take that one as my Grail Page. Did you have any other pages from this story or from any other of Brett Ewins' work that you wanted to choose? Possibly from the Art of Brett Ewins book itself.
Yeah, look, I'm going to go with the front cover of the Art of Brett Ewins.
Nice.
I don't know if anyone's familiar with it. Again, it's one of his... I think this could have really made him a bit more cash, or, you know, if it had sort of... Well, say if it had taken off, it was popular, but Johnny Nemo, definitely a 2000 AD character in its you know, genesis, possibly the magazine more, because it's, you know, a slightly more adult content. It ran in quite a few different publications, in Deadline, obviously, it was packaged in a three issue series in the States. You know, later on, it was also in Strange Days, which we haven't mentioned. That the sort of two or three issues that the comic that Brett did with Brendan McCarthy. But yeah, it's just a great image. The figure rocking back, so you've got these lovely horizontal sort of diagonals. He's got another trademark of Brett Ewins, which is a big gun with holes in the barrel. That's another one of his, lots of those in Bad Company. And I think just the sense of design is great. I think I'm gathering he designed the whole front cover as well, because it does say art editor Brett Ewins. So, he's set against the Union flag, because the thing about Johnny Nemo, he's certainly he's an American style private detective in the classic hard-boiled mold, but he's English or British, and he's that's where the stories are set. So yeah, that's one for me, this one here.
So if your podcast player shows you the cover artwork for this episode, that will be the cover artwork for this episode from the art of Brett Ewins, 2011. Get yourself a copy on Amazon or elsewhere. And also two Grail pages, one for Luke, one for me, from The Haunting of Sector House 9, which you can find, as I say, Case File 7, even if the reproduction might not be absolutely on point. But still, it's a great volume of Judge Dredd stories as well. Citizen Snorks in there to lighten the mood. And also, I know it's not called that, but the Citizen Dave stories in there as well. Mayor Dave.
Mayor Dave.
Yeah. Great stuff, Luke. Well, I mean, it's great to talk about Brett Ewins. As you say, perhaps still underappreciated from that golden age that he had in the 1980s. Wonderful stuff.
It would be great if we could get a bigger volume of his work, because, like I said, it's a lovely little book, but it's a very slight volume. Just saying to anyone from Rebellion out there listening.
I wonder if they've got an Apex edition in the back of their minds, maybe.
It'd be a lovely thing.
Yeah. Okay. Guest projects time, Luke. You've recently been doing covers yourself.
I have, not to such a great degree, obviously, but yeah, I've been lucky enough to tick something off the bucket list of doing some cover artwork for small press publications based here in Melbourne. A friend of mine, Chuck McKenzie, he's an author, sort of science fiction horror. He also runs his own little publication company called Daft Notions, D-A-F-T, Daft Notions, if you want to Google that. He asked me to do the artwork because we knew each other from, he ran a comic shop, bookshop, back in a suburb of Melbourne when I first met him 10, 15 years ago, and he at once said, yes, you can show your artwork and I'll sell your artwork, which is great. When I first started to get back into producing art and doing stencil art for sale, so he sold those pieces. So he approached me and said, yeah, look, could you do some images? So I've done three covers so far for his work. There was a Christmas-based one about aliens taking over a department store during Christmas, so a little novella. So that's a nice little sort of cartoon I did of a store Santa being surrounded by alien tentacles and things. And then he is just released, or is about to any day now, a book called Not Like Us, so a compendium of alien visitation, alien encounter stories. And he said to me, look, just do what you like for this. Do something alien-like. So I did I went for, again, a 50s style, almost like a Mars Attacks, kind of a big grinning alien skull. I had to adapt it from a real skull image I had. So I gave it three eyes and a great big brain cranium, because that's what all aliens have.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. So, that was great. So they're on my, they will be on my Insta page, so... Luke, not Dave. I haven't got a website. I've just been plodding on, still being a fearless primary school teacher,
fighting the good fight. Thank goodness for you.
Yep. Helping to form the next generation
of artists.
It's a big responsibility.
Yeah.
So that's my main job. And yeah, so I just enjoy doing, you know, making art as a past, not pastime, but something to feed the soul when I'm not thinking about school. And also I'm a bit of a miniature painter as well. I'll share that with your friend Conrad.
Right.
yeah, so that's something else, an artistic outlet for me.
Well, look in the show notes for links to those two covers that you've done, and also to Luke Not Dave on Instagram. There'll be a link in the show notes for this episode and on the website at megacitybookclub.com. Perfect, Luke. Thank you very much. Anything else you wanted to mention before we wrap it up?
No, I don't think so. Just, you know, I've covered all my little notes. You know, we didn't talk about music. Music was a big influence in his work, not just art. I could end up just going on again, so I better end it there. But yeah.
Well, a fitting tribute to Brett Ewins, and people keep nudging Rebellion for an Apex edition of his work.
Absolutely.
How about that? If not, The Haunting of Sector House 9 on its own.
Yes. I was going to say, yeah, you never know when a psychically amplified spectre might come knocking at your door. So
exactly, yeah. Great stuff. Thank you very much, Luke.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone for listening to Megacity Book Club. As ever, megacitybookclub.com. We're on all the socials apart from X. You will find me posting the Grail pages in the week that this episode comes out. Email me mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. You can choose a book, you can choose a story, or like Luke has done, you can choose a creator to spotlight on if you want to come on the pod and talk about them. So that'll do us. Until next time, from a haunted Ely Sector House, it's goodbye. And also...
yeah, from Sector House Melbourne, it's a goodbye for me. Wow.